EFT Houston.
Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. This is a pre-recorded show, so unfortunately won't be able to take calls, but it should be really interesting. My guest is Melissa Hamilton. She is a senior lecturer in law and criminal justice at the University of Surrey School of Law in England. When I first encountered her, she was, I think, doing... Melissa, were you doing sort of a guest professorship at UH when I first interviewed you about the Second Amendment?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, that's kind of how we originally connected. And she's currently working on a paper having to do with sentencing algorithms. How many of you knew that jail sentences, bails... things like that were sometimes set by computer algorithm? That's what we're going to be talking about. So first I want to mention that there is an election coming up on August 25th, the Harris County Flood Control District bonds. There is not information online yet, but you can check your voting status, make sure you're registered, make sure you know what ID to bring. You can contact either harrisvotes.com or votetexas.gov, and I will keep you posted on that. So, Melissa, what is risk assessment, just generally? What are we talking about?
So it's basically a method of classification about the probability of an individual's likelihood of reoffending or being a danger to society. The idea is for these risk assessments to inform decision-making in the criminal justice system by officials. So at a very high level, it's the desire to, for example, be able to differentiate those offenders who may be at high risk and for whom then incapacitation may be appropriate from those who pose a low risk for which, you know, some kind of diversion may be more appropriate.
What is incapacitation? Incarceration?
Yes, it could be incarceration, but it also could be things such as, to the extent that the individual's released to the communities, putting more conditions on them for supervision to try to reduce the risk that they pose to society. So the idea is, at a very high level, to also to reduce our reliance on mass incarceration in this country.
Okay. And what is the history of risk assessment in criminal justice?
So we kind of think that criminal justice officials have always, you know, had some kind of thought process about the individual's risk, but it was usually gut instinct. So in more modern times, it's to try to replace that gut instinct with more scientific-based models. And here the science is basically what's called the evidence-based practices movement. And really what that boils down to is, instead of an official's gut instinct, is to rely on science. What does science, the scientific evidence of what factors do correlate with recidivism, and then to rely on them. So what we've seen is a movement through these kind of risk assessments. Originally, and we're talking here about when it moved from the gut instinct to some kind of systematic risk assessment, from about the 1960s and 70s, we were mostly in the criminal justice system using clinical predictions of risk. So, for example, from psychologists. And then it moved from there to use more statistics in what we call actuarial models. And that simply means basically statistical models of prediction. And then the more recent trend is to incorporate into these risk assessments the idea of needs, meaning that if, for example, if the reason that the person is at high risk is because they have a substance abuse problem, well, then it seems that their need might be then to give them substance abuse treatment and therefore reduce their risk to the public.
So what are the perceived benefits of automated risk assessment versus human gut instinct?
I like the emphasis on perceived, because there are some going to be some issues that I think we'll talk about with these perceived benefits. But for particularly automated risk assessment, is they're perceived to be more efficient because the statistical methods are more efficient than having a psychologist, for example, have to do a file review that may take them many hours. It appears to be more equitable. If the same risk assessment is used across the board, then it seems to be more fair as well as more consistent. And it's assumed that these new tools are more neutral, particularly to the extent that they're based on science. And to the more broad perspective, if they do allow officials to, for example, release more offenders than they would have before, then that serves the goal of reducing our reliance on mass incarceration.
In theory.
Yes, in theory.
So these tools predict the risk of what exactly? Is it just recidivism? Is it the risk of some other violent crime or re-perpetrating on some lower-level crime that they have already been charged with?
Yes, yeah, so now we have actually dozens of tools that are available. And one of the reasons that may be a benefit is because some of them are geared more specifically than others. So yes, if we start at a broad level, some of the tools will simply predict what we call general recidivism, which is any reoffense. Others are more specific. For example, there are some very popular tools that are geared specifically to predicting violent reoffending, and then even underlying that one is some tools are available to predict sexual reoffending. Although at the same time, one of the questions that people who use these should ask, although they don't always, is what is the definition for reoffending? So some of the tools, or actually most of them, use some form of arrest, even without conviction. Mm. But then at the same time, particularly for those who score general recidivism, is they will also count any failure on supervision. So, for example, if an individual violates a probation condition, even if it doesn't rise to the level of reoffense, some of these tools will count that as basically a failure.
Effectively, because they're computer algorithms, they're effectively heartless.
That's one of the perceived values, although that's not necessarily the case.
It can cut both ways, can't it? Because you're heartless, on the one hand, you're not likely to be too soft, but on the other hand, you sort of lose any quality of mercy or understanding. It's all black and white. So how widely are these algorithms in use, and when did they sort of pass into common use?
They're used, this can vary by jurisdiction and by department, but they're basically used across the United States at multiple decision points. So the tools now, and this is a relatively recent development, are used or can be used across an individual's basically lifespan in the criminal justice system. So, for example, if police responding to a scene of a domestic violence call, there are some tools available for the police then to assess what is the potential that this domestic violence relationship is going to turn lethal. And so that may then inform the officer of, for example, intervening when otherwise they would not. These tools are available for pretrial decisions, such as whether to grant pretrial bail, or if granting pretrial bail, what kind of conditions to pose on the offender. They're being used in institutional placement decisions. For example, correctional officials may rely on a risk assessment tool to determine whether to place the person in maximum security versus low security. They're used now at sentencing to determine a person's sentence and length of sentence. They're now used for parole decisions and whether to grant parole, and then to the extent that the person is released on probation or parole, they're using to inform decisions about what kind of conditions to place on the individual in probation or parole.
Are all of these risk assessment tools based on some kind of algorithm, or do any of them work any other way? And to what extent are they essentially AI expert systems that sort of learn as they go versus just being strictly programmed?
Yeah, so the word algorithm often has a connotation of complexity. And really what we mean here by an algorithm is simply a systematic computation or a formula. And yes, all of them are based on some kind of formula. Some are much more simplistic than others. So, for example, at the one of the most basic tools is actually the most popular one used in violence reoffending. It's based on 12 different factors, and it allows the assessor can score it basically by, you know, doing scoring on paper. So the way these tend to work is that the more points that are accumulated when the person is scoring the tool, the greater the risk. Now, for purposes of that, some of these tools have some kind of artificial intelligence component, but here what we really mean is using computers, for example, to crunch the numbers to search for patterns. The patterns, what we mean there is what it's the artificial intelligence-led tools are looking for what patterns of behavior or and or characteristics of the individuals tend together to be even more predictive of recidivism than any one of them in any one of those together.
But they're not heuristic or learning systems. Basically, there's, in a sense, a rigid formula. And as you say, a human inputs the information, and then the computer simply crunches the numbers based on the algorithms.
Well, that can be true, although some of the tools are purported to be learning tools to allow the computer to learn. Again, if we look back at this idea of searching for patterns, that is would qualify as machine learning. But only a few, relative few of the tools are at that level at this stage. But I expect that will change in, you know, very quickly. And one of the reasons for that is as we gain more knowledge about how to do these risk tools, as well as simple computation abilities. So our, simply our laptops, for example, can today do a lot more statistical analysis than they could have just a couple years ago. So it's just the availability of technological advancement is going to turn most of these tools, I think, into more artificial intelligence-based models.
So how, if these tools are supposed to be objective, I guess varying degrees of transparency, how can they be biased?
One way is that it requires you to put data in. So these tools were developed on what we call historical samples, which basically here simply means that they look at the availability of data where individual defendants were released from a system, usually a prison, and then they were tracked in terms of their recidivism. And the historical samples then will have data for which the developers will crunch the numbers. What does the data, for example, say about what factors seem to correlate with recidivism versus what factors seem to correlate with non-recidivism? And so that's how they develop these models, which is, again, based on the science of it, which is what factors are significantly predictive of recidivism, and then the tools will collect the significant factors, and then they'll weight them in their algorithm. And the weights simply mean that the science again indicates some factors are simply more strongly predictive of recidivism than others, and then a good algorithm will weight that accordingly.
So essentially when it comes to sentencing algorithms passed as prologue?
Yes, particularly because in risk assessment in criminal justice, one of the most common factors and the most heavily weighted is criminal history. So one of the reasons that these algorithms can be biased is if they're based on biased past practices, then it carries that bias through the algorithm, and then it's going to infect recidivism predictions for future outcomes. One of the reasons is, recall the idea of criminal history, is criminal history can be based, for example, on the arrest records of individuals. Well, we have plenty of experience in criminal justice with knowing that a lot of arrest decisions may be based on biased decisions of police officers, whether conscious or not. And so what we find is that minorities, for example, will have higher criminal histories, and it could simply be not necessarily that they offended more or committed more crimes, but it could be because their neighborhoods, for example, were policed, more heavily policed, and police were more likely to make arrests regardless of crime rates or individuals. So it's kind of a garbage in, garbage out. So to the extent that these models are based on biased data, they're going to reproduce biased outcomes.
Okay, we're going to touch on that in just a second. I'm going to do a quick break here. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is a pre-recorded program, so while I always appreciate my callers, unfortunately at this time I cannot take phone calls. Do remember, you can support KPFT by going to kpft.org and clicking on the donate jar. Another way that doesn't cost anything is just to tell your friends about KPFT. Tell them about maybe shows you like that you think would interest them, or shows that maybe you don't find interesting but that they might like, and just kind of help get out the word for kpft.org. You can also follow me on my blog at thinkwingradio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at thinkwingradio, and that's sometimes a good way to contact me as well. Okay, so back to this. So if you have a situation where, as you say, certain ethnic groups, certain neighborhoods are what we call now over-policed, people are more likely to be considered offenders for what in other areas or other racial groups might be considered innocuous behaviors. Some of the ridiculous things we've seen are people barbecuing and having the cops called, a kid mowing the lawn and having the cops called. I mean, it gets to be really very upsetting. So if these computers are basing their decisions on people that have already been over-policed, the point you're making is that's one of the ways that bias creeps into the system. It perpetuates a system of what might loosely be called legal abuse.
Yes, it will. And it's not just, I'm not picking just on police, because as you know, I'm a former police officer myself, and as well as a former corrections officer. But this can build in biases from other, you know, non-criminal justice actors. So, for example, some of the common factors in these tools are things such as educational level, occupation, employability. And you can imagine that those kind of things also can simply replicate bias by other actors, whether governmental or private actors in the system, or just in the world and in their communities.
And, of course, when you talk about employability, just the fact that now you have to say you've been arrested and maybe convicted of a misdemeanor, that is going to affect your employability. So it becomes a vicious cycle.
Yes, it's going to be a self-perpetuating cycle and almost a self-fulfilling prophecy as well. And what I mean by that is, to the extent that a person then is going to be assessed as high risk, then that's actually going to undermine that person's ability for a successful reentry. For one of the ways that will work, for example, is in a pretrial context, suggest that an individual is scored as high risk. Well, then he's more likely to be detained pretrial. And studies consistently show that pretrial detention, it predicts the greater likelihood of being convicted, the greater likelihood of being sentenced to imprisonment, and then longer sentence.
So now, pretrial detention, does that mean no bail, or does that mean simply setting a bail you know that the offender can't possibly reach?
Either. So it's just what's more important is the fact that the person continues to be detained. So it not only reflects then past biases, but then can be a self-fulfilling prophecy of undermining the person's ability to succeed in the future, at least to the extent that they get some kind of high-risk outcome from the tool.
I think one of the things that people get suspicious of is, much like electronic voting machines, the software behind it, the programming, is generally proprietary. They may share some of the items they're inputting, but how the algorithm reaches certain conclusions is proprietary. So you're never quite sure how it's weighing various factors. No one can go in and make an objective evaluation of it.
Well, that's true for many of the tools, but not all. So because we have so many tools now, there are some of them are very open. So some of the developers have been open from the beginning about what samples, for example, they tested it on. Some of these tools, you can download the tool off the internet for free.
So they're open source.
Open and transparent.
They're open source, in other words?
Yes, but others are, the ones that are at higher dispute are, as you said, proprietary. They're owned by companies who regard them as trade secrets, and those are the ones that are not releasing a lot of this information about how the tools were even developed or what their weighting system is. And so, as you can imagine, in the legal system, the challenges are legal challenges are more likely on those proprietary tools than they are on basically the open source ones. I'll give you an example. I want to give a shout out to, I think, one group that's doing it really well is the Pennsylvania Sentencing Commission. Now, they're formally charged by their legislature to incorporate risk assessment tools into sentencing decisions. And so they were also tasked with developing their own tool so that it would be validated on the Pennsylvania, you know, citizenry. And they have been very open at publishing all sorts of information about how these tools are being created. And I think even more so, they've gone to an extreme, I think in a very good way, is they're also opening for opening up for public debate about what some of these items that may be included in the tool should be or shouldn't be. Because even though science indicates a particular factor is predictive of recidivism, that doesn't mean it's value-free. So one of the challenges in all of this, for instance, is it legal, ethical, moral to incorporate, for example, gender directly into a tool when gender scientifically has significant predictive value? And so that's one of the struggles that we are currently undergoing in the risk assessment field itself.
And we're going to get to that in one moment. I have one more question before we do, though, and that is that there has been some media attention that these algorithms tend to be racist. And in our personal discussions, we've discussed the fact that there really isn't any such thing as black culture or Hispanic culture, that there are many, many subdivisions based on region and national origin, and you know, some people have different ways of expressing anger, love, celebration, reacting to authority, and these things are not necessarily, because they're so variable, they're so, these differences are so numerous, how can any algorithm properly account for them?
Yes, that's very true. And so it's this idea of potential cultural bias or cultural insensitivity or sensitivity in these algorithms. So one of the scientific flaws that are unfortunately being replicated in risk assessment practices is the assumption sometimes by officials that if a tool is, quote, validated on one population, that means that it can be applied to any other population. And that's actually not true from a scientific perspective because, as you indicated, there can be very significant cultural differences between groups that are relevant to risk.
Well, really, among groups that that say a white officer might not perceive any distinctions in.
Correct. So, as some examples, some of the tools will ask in an interview ask certain questions about, for example, criminal value systems or pro-social attitudes with the defendants themselves. And from a cultural perspective, we know that individuals will answer those questions differently depending on their cultural background as well as norms. So, for example, women will answer these questions differently than men. That may not necessarily mean that one group is at higher risk. It's just that culturally they may consider the question and interpret it differently. But in terms of the racist algorithm, a group of investigative journalists with a ProPublica a couple years ago analyzed a particularly popular risk tool on a sample of offenders in Florida. And what they found was that, or at least they determined, it was biased against blacks. And so that's how the racist algorithm argument came up. Now, I will say that the creator of the tool, which is a corporation, did their own statistical analyses, and their conclusion was it was not biased. And both of them are correct, even though they come to different conclusions. And you might say, how can that possibly be? Well, in the risk field, we have now multiple definitions of algorithmic fairness, which some of them are inconsistent with each other. And so the argument there is that ProPublica was pointing to some algorithmic fairness statistics, while the company who created the tool was simply referring to other statistics. And basically, the tool cannot comply with both definitions. And so they're basically talking apples and oranges there.
Well, I think, was it Mark Twain that said that there are three kinds of lies, damn lies, and statistics?
Yes, and so this is an example of, if you want to make an argument that a particular risk assessment tool is biased, you simply go through and look through the various definitions of algorithmic fairness, and you can pick out the ones that will support your decision or your, you know, desired outcome. And so, yeah, even statistics can somewhat be manipulated, or at least there are differences in value judgments about which of these algorithmic fairness tools should be or outcomes should be preferred over others.
Okay, let me do a quick station ID, and then we'll get to the other part of this discussion about sexual bias. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My guest is Melissa Hamilton. She's a senior lecturer in law and criminal justice at the University of Surrey School of Law in England. She is a JD, PhD, has been a police officer, corrections officer, so has some considerable background and insight into these topics. And don't forget, you can support KPFT by going to kpft.org, clicking on the donate jar. I believe that next week we're going to be asking you to do that quite a bit. So KPFT, it's all tax deductible if you itemize, and we'll take any gift, big or small, $5, $50, $500, anything in between, maybe a couple of bucks a month, that's okay. And you can also follow me at thinkwingradio.com or on Twitter at thinkwingradio. Okay, getting back to the topic. So let's start with something very fundamental. There is a thing in biological science called sexual dimorphism, which basically says, in essence, that the sexes are different. In some species, males are larger, colored differently, and females are smaller and duller colored. In other species, it's the reverse. But it is recognized in animals and humans that there are well-documented, well-understood, easily recognizable, in some cases, sexual differences, and that is called sexual dimorphism. So how, based on sexual dimorphism, the fact that there are good reasons to believe that in humans, men and women not only look different, men are bigger, more muscular, women tend to be smaller, and other differences, how can that algorithm, or does that algorithm, allow for whatever those differences are when one enters the criminal justice system? And what are the differences, for some examples?
Yes, yeah, so it's, sexual dimorphism is, yes, about certain physical differences that in the sexes that are not necessarily created by sexual organ differences, but it also includes behavioral differences. And particularly for crime, we just pretty much consistently across culture as well as across time is women simply are far less likely to offend than men for most crimes. You know, what the one exception might be prostitution.
Yeah, the crimes tend to be different as well.
Yes, yeah, so to the extent that, for example, women commit violent crime. Of course, they commit it far less likely, but they're much more likely to commit violent crime in conjunction with a male partner. Men are, you know, not as likely, or we don't see them impacted by females as much when they commit violent offenses. And so, if a risk tool does not really,
I'm sorry, clarify
gender,
that. Do you mean that women are more likely to offend against men, whereas men are more likely to be sort of equal opportunity offenders based on gender?
No, more about when women violently offend, it's more likely because they were pressured to by a male partner. Men are more likely to commit violent crime on their own without pressure from anybody. But it's, so it's just the...
So men are more likely to commit without provocation. Women are more likely to require some kind of provocation would be a shorthand way of saying it.
Yes, but more specifically, we see it in one direction, which is being provoked or doing it at the behest of a man, a male partner, is the consistent trend that we see. Hmm. But in other words, that there are differences also, not only to in the rates of offending by men and women, but the reasons that they offend. And when risk instruments don't include gender-responsive variables, then they just are much poorer at predicting reoffending by women. And unfortunately, most of these tools, if not the vast majority, have mostly been normed on a hugely male, if not 100% male population. And so we see a lot of times that their tools are simply poor predictors for women because they haven't included the factors that are more relevant to predicting reoffense by women, such as the role of parental stress, which affects women more than men, the role of prior victimization, which also is more contributing to offending in women than men, and having trauma as part of their current troubles is highly predictive of women reoffending, and it doesn't matter as much for men. Now, some of the tools have tried to incorporate some of these gender-based, at least female responsive factors, but they've gotten some pushback from officials or the public who thinks it's inappropriate to include a protective grouping in these tools such as gender or race.
What's kind of ironic, or maybe not ironic, maybe just interesting, is this has actually been a problem across scientific disciplines. Generally, biology experiments on pharmaceuticals, basic research, almost always tends to focus on either male humans or animal males. It's actually only after many, many years of activism by women and some scientists, some male scientists, that even the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, have now set up an incentive system where allowing for sexual dimorphism in your study, in your results, at least testing for sexual dimorphism, actually gets you points when they are evaluating grant applications. But this is a relatively new phenomenon now, requiring that and understanding, yes, there can be sexual differences in how an animal or a human will respond to various pharmacological inputs.
Yes, and that's kind of replicated here in terms of, again, testing the tool on a mostly male population and simply assuming that it will apply to females when it ignores gender differences. So scientifically, it is pretty clear that gender, either directly or by proxy through gender responsive variables, improve statistically the test tool. The problem, though, is number one, having enough studies that did include a sufficient number of females. But again, it's the idea, it's also you have science versus ethics. And that's the battle. Is it ethical to include gender when obviously the people cannot change their gender? Are they, for example, if we do this, if we include gender, and the result will be more negative against males because males are more likely to reoffend, is that fair to males who can't change their gender to female?
But that's very interesting because it doesn't ask the question of, but is this unfair to females?
Yeah, exactly. So it's just which side of the coin are you basing your argument?
So there's a bias in application just going in.
Yes. But there's not, interestingly, a consistent legal conclusion on that question with respect to gender. So we have some legal authorities adamantly proclaim that including gender as a risk factor when there is a criminal justice outcome differential is illegal. Other legal scholars, though, indicate, no, it's not illegal as long as the government can show that it has some relevance to what you're doing, which is here is if it has some relevance and particularly a significant relevance to reoffending, then maybe it's actually not unfair. And in fact, it could be discriminatory against women.
How much
we did have. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, how much weight is typically given to these algorithms in sentencing, adjudication, bail decisions? Is it just a percentage, or is it like marching orders? Is there human input as to evaluating the algorithm output and saying, well, I think that's a little too lenient, I think that's a little too harsh?
That varies, although there is, for example, in the Virginia sentencing system, is the legislature has required that the sentencer consider a risk assessment tool, which includes gender. They must consider it in sentencing, and it has a direct impact on the sentence involved, at least for sex offense cases specifically. Now, they're the ones who've gone out the most extreme in terms of there being very little discretion in the decision here being a sentence based on a risk tool that includes gender. In most systems, though, the tools inform decisions, but they're not dispositive of decisions. And so we could
dispositive meaning what precisely?
Another example of a dispositive would be for if a system said you must release pretrial bail or even without bail if the risk assessment, for example, comes up low risk. That would be a dispositive. Most that actually formally incorporate risk assessment in the pretrial context, for example, indicate that it's one of several factors or things that you ought to consider. And indeed, most of these tools expressly allow the assessor, meaning the individual who's scoring the tool, to override the result. And what that means is that because the developers understand they couldn't possibly have included every relevant factor in their tool, is there could be some idiosyncratic characteristic in the case where the risk assessment tool is just not going to do a good job. So it's generally believed that about 10% of these risk assessment tools are overrides, meaning that the assessor said, okay, I scored it, but I think that for some reason this is not an accurate score, and therefore I'm going to either increase the risk level judgment or decrease it, although mostly it's an increase rather than a decrease.
So that's interesting. So in some cases, even the heartless algorithm is overruled by a human to be even more heartless, in a sense.
Yes. So
the algorithm, the computer, isn't heartless and cold enough. The human is like, no, we're really going to hit the person with this.
That could be. And that's a reason that these tools are not necessarily always, transparent or consistent or, equitable.
How often does it go the other way? Do you have any statistics on how often they overrule and give a more lenient decision?
I do have some. So some of the tools, as an example, will indicate that for sex offenders specifically, never issue a low-risk outcome. So they kind of, the tool developer there, overrode their own tool based specifically on sex offenders. And I've seen that very commonly as well. So risk assessment has been extremely important in the sex offender civil commitment world, and that's where civil commitment is basically where sex offenders, convicted sex offenders, are nearing the end of their prison term. So they're, have served their entire sentence, and if the system believes that they are sexual predators, then the state who has these laws, such as Texas, will simply transfer them from a prison to a civil facility, and they generally never get released.
Mm.
And they're heavily reliant on these risk assessments. And what I've seen there is consistently, if the assessor wants to override, particularly if it's an assessor for the government versus an assessor for the defendant, will consistently override to an increased risk level and almost never to a lesser risk level.
So, of course, the irony here is that the whole point of the algorithm is to take the human gut out of it and be more objective. And essentially humans are more likely to override the decision and be harsher than they are to override the decision and be more lenient, essentially making the whole process less objective.
Yes. So, yes.
So that's kind of funny. It's like, well, then what do you have the algorithm for? I know you're working on a paper doing a statistical analysis of whether or not there is gender bias specifically and how these algorithms work more generally and how they're created. So just briefly, tell us a little about that particular work you're doing.
Okay, so I'm using a very popular risk tool. It's one of those that are proprietary, and using a real data set. And so what I found is consistent over-classifications of risk for females. Now, interestingly, meaning that there, if you look at, let me give you an example of the worst of it. This particular tool has different risk scales for general recidivism and violent recidivism. In the violent recidivism risk scale, of those offenders who are assessed at high risk, the males went on to recidivate from a violent perspective at a rate of 52%. Females only recidivated violently at a rate of 25%, even though both groups were classified at high risk. And so what that resulted is significant overclassification of women, at least on that particular risk scale. The interesting thing there is that the developers of that tool actually have gendered risk scales. They actually offer a different norming for male offenders than female offenders. The thing is that this particular jurisdiction, probably for political correctness, simply decided or elected not to employ those different risk scales, and this is the result, which is overclassification of women into the higher risk groupings that is unjustified by their past or by the tool itself.
Well, I can see a scenario, not so much a political correctness scenario, but a liability scenario, where if they start judging, adjudicating men and women separately, you can predict that unless there is already some kind of law or justification, scientific justification in place, you can predict that there's going to be a bias lawsuit. Why, you know, by a man, probably, why are you sentencing women more lightly than men? I argue that that is a discriminatory effect. So, I mean, I don't know that political correctness is the issue so much as, well, you know, we know we're going to get sued if we treat these people differently. We might as well treat them the same.
Well, yeah, that's a very astute observation, which has already been lived, meaning that there was a case that just was decided in the Wisconsin Supreme Court just last month, exactly on that argument, where an offender who challenged the particular tool that I studied, and his jurisdiction actually did use the different gendered scales, and he argued it was then biased against him or discriminatory. Now, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, though, said no, it is not, because it's scientifically gender is relevant to recidivism, and therefore it's relevant to consider it. Now, that doesn't mean from a legal perspective that that's precedent and then the question is done with. Yes, it is a Supreme Court of a state. That's important, but that's simply one outlier decision at this point.
It doesn't
mean that it's not going to be litigated.
I think it's been explained to me that precedent is what the Supreme Court does, whereas I think the term is advisory is what a higher court at a state level does, or an appeal court level.
Kind of. Now, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is precedent in Wisconsin, so lower courts would have to abide by them. But yes, it is going to be relevant to other states, but it's not dispositive for other judges outside of Wisconsin.
Now, I'm going to do a quick ID so I don't have to do it later. You're listening to ThinkWing Radio on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. We are on the air because of you guys. It's a community-supported radio station. KPFT.org is the homepage for KPFT. And you can learn about upcoming events, you can find programming details, you can occasionally give money, and of course, I always encourage you to tell your friends about KPFT, the shows you think you'll like. We are probably the only source of progressive call-in talk radio in town. While I was here, Egberto Willis was doing his Politics Done Right. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to listen and call in, but maybe next time. You can follow me on thinkwingradio.com. I always post the shows that I'm doing, the links that I'm using, and eventually post the audio from the program. Or you can go to archive.kpft.org and listen to pretty much any of the shows that have been broadcast up to, I think, 90 days before they cycle out. You can also follow me on Twitter, at thinkwingradio. So one of the things we talked about is the equivalent of the financial prospectuses that state past performance is no guarantee of future results. In the case of predictive algorithms, to what extent are past histories successfully modeled, and how well do they predict real outcomes? Is there any standardized way of assessing this?
There is, and it's called, validation studies. So that's relevant not only to past, but also the cultural differences we talked about. But for instance, in terms of the past being relevant to the future, we know that crime rates have varied in this country over time. So if a tool, for example, was developed on populations or samples in the 1980s and 90s when our crime rates, specifically our violent crime rates, really high, if you take those same assumptions of extremely high rates of reoffending and apply them to new defendants, new samples today, you're going to over-predict again, because our crime rates have gone down significantly across the board, both general recidivism, drug recidivism, as well as violent recidivism. So if the developmental sample, for instance, if at the high-risk group, and I'm just plucking a number out of thin air, if 50% of them reoffended, and you now apply that tool to a new group and you assume that 50% of the new people that are assessed at high risk are going to reoffend, is then you're over-predicting because times have changed, recidivism rates have changed. But it's also true of another aspect. Even though the science indicates that an individual's criminal history is highly predictive of reoffending, is what about rehabilitation? It's denying the rehabilitation potential of the individual.
Excellent point. Is there any rehabilitation assessment in potential included in any of these algorithms?
Some of them, yes. And what we call that is if they include dynamic factors. Many of them don't. Some of the more sophisticated ones do. So, for instance, if the person successfully had a substance abuse problem and successfully completed a substance abuse program, if the tool includes that treatment outcome, then that's going to assist the model. But many of them do not include these dynamic factors, in part because some of the tools were intentionally created to be very easily scored. And it's easier to score static factors, which means those things that don't change, such as your sex, your ethnicity, your criminal history, except criminal history can get worse but not better, that's more easily scored than if it incorporates dynamics. So part of the issue here is the efficiency of the system versus improving the predictability by including those dynamic factors that may be more timely and require more resources to assess and then to score.
I think human bias generally, complex answers tend to be better answers, but for humans, simple answers tend to be more satisfying answers. You find that?
Yes, and there's a literature now on how these risk results are communicated. How can they basically infect the individual's assessment or understanding of the risk outcome? Meaning that, for example, there are some studies that indicate if the assessor simply says to the decision maker, say, this person was scored at high risk, period, the decision maker has a different perspective on the risk of the probability of this individual offending than if the assessor says, this person was assessed at high risk and here are the factors that made him high risk. So what these studies are showing is the more information they give can impact the decision maker's understanding of the risk tool and their than their conclusion on the level of risk that the individual is going poses to society.
Basically, nuance matters.
Yes. Or yes, and the other more critical perspective would be it can be manipulated by what information and how much information is given.
And that's where the humans become more problematic than the computer algorithms. There is a saying that to err is human, to really screw up it takes a computer. Generally, computers take human errors or assumptions and magnify them, sometimes exponentially. Once a computer has decided the future, does case management become in some ways a self-fulfilling prophecy?
It does, in part because these results coming from a computer versus a human scoring on a piece of paper, it carries with it the guise of science. And we love science. We just put a whole lot more reliance upon science than we do on, you know, human clinical judgment. So it kind of makes the risk outcome seem more important, seem more reliable than maybe it otherwise should be. The other issue is when you have science like this, particularly like this, in the criminal justice system, is lawyers just don't understand the science of it. And so they don't ask the right questions. They don't have the appropriate challenges. And we've seen this in some of the judicial decisions on risk assessment where the judges also seem to struggle with the science of this. And therefore, they might get, you know, their decisions may be incorrect to the extent that they did not understand some of the science underlying it. That same decision I mentioned in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, for example, is there was a dissenting judge who made that same charge about her colleagues. She said, "We don't understand this well enough. I think we may have screwed this up because of that lack of understanding of the science."
I think one question that anyone who's been listening to this ultimately will have, to what extent is this like the Minority Report movie, where you have, of course, humans are involved in that particular loop, but essentially what you've got is software predicting crimes so far in advance that people are arrested for a crime they haven't committed yet, but that they are predicted to commit. Now, we're not talking about algorithms that extreme, but to what extent is this like that, or to what extent could it become more like that?
It is like that. So it's making a prediction of some future human action. And we know that it's hard to predict what humans will do in the future. Now, they're actually not making an arrest. That would not be legal, but there are extreme negative consequences that can come from these risk assessments. So, for example, the individual could be sentenced to a longer period of incarceration. The individual may not be released pretrial. The individual may be, if released, given more conditions with a high-risk assessment based on this predictions of what these individuals in terms of crime will do in the future. The other big issue, just to kind of end on another big thing for listeners to think about, is these assessments are based on group data. They're not individualized assessments as we seem to be using them for. So it's not just a prediction of what the individual will do in the future, it's a prediction of what the group of individuals of which this individual is a member will do in the future. So to that extent, one of the challenges is these data-driven tools are really not individualized to the defendant, but the consequences are.
We have several minutes yet, so I want to kind of get to a more general question. To what extent is there objective science? You and I talked about this privately, that there have not necessarily been any designed experiments where, say, from the first time someone enters the system and then trying to develop an if-then flowchart of if a person with these pre-assessed traits enters the system, is sentenced a certain way, and they have outcomes, to what extent can or has an experiment been designed to try to really validate not only the algorithms, but to try to validate to what extent sentencing affects recidivism in the future?
But we couldn't really do a true experiment in the criminal justice system because when you were talking about criminal justice outcomes that have significant effects on individuals' lives in terms of their privacy, their freedom, and what have you, is we can't truly have a control group and a experimental group that has significant consequences to the individual. But what you're, I think what we can do if there, you know, a government wanted to fund it, is to do what's called a longitudinal analysis, which is basically following individuals through the criminal justice system, tracking these various risk assessment results. But also you'd have to be tracking what kinds of services are being offered individuals versus others who are not getting those same services.
And basically do a statistic analysis of what seems to have better outcomes overall.
Yeah, so it's an emphasis on these dynamic factors. Is if our one of the basis of doing risk assessment in the first place is to reduce reliance on incarceration and potentially improve reentry, is we're going to have the criminal justice officials are going to have to incorporate dynamic service provision to reduce risk, and some jurisdictions are doing that much better than others today in terms of wanting these risk assessments to also be needs assessments so that the criminal justice officials can assign appropriate programming to the individual to reduce their risk, which actually benefits not just the individual, but benefits society as well.
You know, the word penitentiary actually comes from penitence. The idea was to send people to penitentiary so that they could think about their crimes, hopefully be rehabilitated and come out as better people. I think that the understanding of the word, which is the intent of a penitentiary, the loss of that understanding has a lot to do with how much we incarcerate today. We're kind of running out of time. Is there anything you'd like to take maybe 30 seconds for and wrap up?
Yeah, so even though I've talked a lot about some of the negative aspects of these risk assessment tools, is I still applaud criminal justice officials and legislators who want to incorporate these tools, because many, if not all, most of them, I think, have laudable goals, which is to reduce reliance on mass incarceration, to improve the outcomes of offenders, and to do it in more fair and just ways. It's just I want to caution them about it's not as simple as thinking this is science and therefore everything is going to be a panacea. Is still consider there are issues with the science of it and then the ethics, norms, and legality of it.
At least the effort is being made. My guest has been Melissa Hamilton. She's a senior lecturer in law and criminal justice at the University of Surrey School of Law in England. She is a JD, PhD, has experience both as a police officer and a corrections officer, and now she's a lecturer and professor. I thank you very much for coming on the show and doing this with me, and if there's enough interest, perhaps we can do it live so that people can ask you questions.
Very good. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm going to leave with a quote. It's David Fowler, his favorite quote from me. He once asked, do we send people to prison as punishment, or do we send them to prison for punishment? That's actually a very, very deep question if you think about it. It's subtle. I thank Melissa for being on the show. Perhaps we can do it again sometime live. And I will speak to you guys next week, and we'll actually do call-in. I hope you have a great week. Take care. Goodbye.
KPFT's local station board meeting will be held Wednesday from 7 to 10 p.m. at Montrose Center, 401 Brainerd Street. Public comment is allowed from 8 to 8:30. For more information, call 713-526-4000 or go to kpft.org.
Come on out and enjoy an evening of music and poetry. KPFT and Song Pacifica invite you to a summer festival event benefiting our radio station. There will be musical stylings of Ruben Moreno and his blues rock and Zydeco band, the jazz and blues vocals of Evelyn Rubio and the group Bayou City Swing with their gypsy jazz sound, along with alternative rhythms of No Te Mueras en Mi Casa and some electronic music as well. Also featured will be poetry from writers such as Cronopios de Houston, Miriam Damares, Enrique Infante, and the writer Leslie Contreras Schwartz. Please join us for this benefit show for KPFT at Fitzgerald's, 2706 White Oak Drive, on Sunday, July 22nd.